Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Somme TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. We have a real good one today. Paul Greco, who is the owner of Terroir Wine Bar in New York City, who's been on the show, was a cast member in Somme Into the Bottle, my second film, is on today with a question. Is The Breakfast Club the greatest wine film ever made? I know it sounds crazy, and we have been drinking over the course of many years, but I think Paul might be onto something here. So him and I are going to dissect the John Hughes film, The Breakfast Club, which I would recommend you have seen, and I hope that all of you have, please God, and try to decide, is it the greatest wine film ever made? And hold your judgment until the end of this podcast if you think we're crazy. It's fine either way. Before that, I do want to say, SomTV.com, we have a series called Verticals that I have directed all of the episodes, and it is kind of an extension of Into the Bottle, where we take individual wineries and tell their stories, the history, the families, the whole deal. And season two is coming very, very soon. It is coming in February, and I cannot wait. The premiere episode has to do with Mayacamas Vineyards. It involves a recently discovered Prohibition-era cave in the side of a mountain. It involves some of the greatest wines you can find in California, and in a hell of a story. Make sure you sign up for Somme TV, SomTV.com. It's $49.99 for the year. Verticals is coming. An all-new season of Blind Tasting Sessions is coming, which is by far the best we've had yet. And then, of course, we have tons of new films, including an entire new trilogy of Somme films that I have almost completely finished filming. So lots coming. Without further ado, let's talk about two of my favorite things in the world, movies and wine. Paul, it is always a pleasure to have you on the Somme TV podcast. You are a ball of fire.
I'm honored you had me back. Generally, people give me just one shot and they're done, they're spent. I'm over-caffeinated, I'm too hyped up, and they can't deal with that shit. So the fact that you allowed me back for a second time, my mom is maybe the happiest person on the planet Earth right now that someone wanted me.
Well, I tell you, like I always say on this podcast, my mom's the only one who makes it to the end of it. But so this is great. We are going to do what is my favorite thing in the world to do on this podcast, which is take things that seemingly have nothing to do with wine and pair them with wine. And today we are going to talk about a movie that I know is very near and dear to both of our hearts. And anybody who's over the age of probably what's the age cutoff for The Breakfast Club?
Are you kidding? We're not going to be ageist now, are we, buddy?
Well, I mean, I just think that there aren't a lot of people, you know, that are 14 on TikTok that are talking about The Breakfast Club. I don't mean to
listen. If anyone ageist. Has seen Pitch Perfect, then that whole generation of people who might not have watched it in the 80s, many of us, many folks who didn't follow up with it thereafter, saw Pitch Perfect. And the seminal thing is the goddamn Breakfast Club. So it was introduced to a whole new generation of people. Everyone knows this goddamn movie, Jason. Let's be honest.
This is great. I love that. Well, we are going to talk about The Breakfast Club. And Paul has decoded it as a secret language for wine. Right? Is that a good way to say that?
You know, I think ultimately what John Hughes was doing back in 1985 when he created this movie, when he filmed this movie, it was the second movie, after all, that he wanted to take the typical struggle of teenagers and the five stereotypes and all of those things. But what he didn't tell people is that he was making a movie about wine. And let's be honest, one of the greatest wine movies sideways is not so much a wine movie as it is the journey of an alcoholic. So let's discount that. The greatest wine movie of all time is The Breakfast Club, period. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Fantastic. This is going to be, buckle up, everybody. Here we go. I think we have to put a little bit of context. You know, everybody knows who John Hughes is, I believe. But let's put a little bit of context as far as how important John Hughes is to American film, the what I would call the high school film genre, if that is so, you know, if that is a genre. I think it's really important to understand what the world was like before he came in and did things like, you know, Weird Science or Ferris Bueller's Day Off or The Breakfast Club. Paul, how would you put John Hughes as a director and a storyteller into the zeitgeist of his time?
This is a wine question, right? Essentially, he is the Riesling of Hollywood. Enough said. Done. You know, he had great stories to tell. People didn't think there was initially enough there to tell it. But when they got into the meat of the matter, he told the story, not a story, the story of this age bracket, this burgeoning age group of people who were going to change the world. And dude, isn't that what Riesling goddamn does? At least in my mind, it is.
Comparing a director to Riesling, we're already off to the right thing. I think John Hughes is a guy who had these, by all accounts, a very tortured relationship with Hollywood. He had a hard time with a lot of the critical response. He had a lot of voices in his head, and I don't mean like in a schizophrenic or a multiple personality way. I mean he had a lot of stories. You know, this is a guy who was behind Adventures in Babysitting, writing that, the Home Alone series. You know, there are so many things that John Hughes touched, Uncle Buck, and a film that I love that's horribly maligned, which is called Dutch. I love this movie. He did so many of these kind of great, I mean, I think he wrote Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I mean, this is a guy that mastered the road movie. He mastered the high school movie, but he championed people who didn't have a voice, which I think is the most important thing from my appreciation of John Hughes, which brings us to The Breakfast Club and setting up the movie. Give me a plot line. What is this film about? And not the wine thing, just what's The Breakfast Club's like one-liner, Paul?
It is the story of a detention at Shermer High School on a Saturday, March 24th, 1984. Five students show up, 7 a.m. Who welcomes them? Assistant Principal Richard Vernon. We have Claire Standish. We have John Bender. We have Allison Reynolds. We have Brian Johnson. We have Andrew Clark. Great characters, maybe better defined or thought of by their peer group as the snob, the punk, the kook, the geek, the jock. And they are going to spend 9 hours together in the library. And their assignment, while they are spending 9 hours in the library, not saying a word, not leaving that room, is to write a 1,000-word essay in which each must describe who you think you are. And as soon as Vernon leaves the room, all hell breaks loose. But let's, you know, even before he leaves the room, John Bender is already poking him in the ribs. Before Vernon leaves, Bender has got himself an additional 8 weeks of detention. It's insane. And you think it's just going to be a normal Saturday detention, da-da-da-da-da. And lo and behold, it's what we learn about these individuals, what they learn about each other, that ultimately they're more alike than they are different. It's about stereotypes being known, stereotypes being blown apart. It is the classic high school movie where we think, as kids, teenagers, no one understands us. No one can empathize with my situation. Mom doesn't understand me. Dad doesn't understand me. The teachers don't get me. My friends don't give me the time of day. I'm trying to figure out a friend group to fit into. Cliques, all of this stuff. The most insane time of our lives is shown in The Breakfast Club.
So now, how is this a wine movie, Paul? Explain to me how this is the greatest wine movie ever made.
Because we take these five characters, these traits, the snob, the punk, the kook, the geek, the jock, and we think about those ideas, and we start thinking about the snob. Well, that's sort of, you know, maybe a little like champagne. And the punk, well, there's wines like that out there, dare I say, Riesling. And the kook, could that be orange wine? Could that be natural wine? And then there's the geek, maybe, just maybe, that's Burgundy. And the jock, that is these big, bombastic wines that have risen up over the last 30 years. And we lock these wines into their respective corners. And we advocate for them. I'm a Riesling fanatic at the expense of everything else. But as you spend time with each one of these wines, and or grapes, and or wine regions, you realize that we are committing the same sins that Assistant Principal Richard Vernon did on that Saturday. You can't lock them into that. They are much more than that. Let's think about Champagne the Snob. Well, over the last 20-odd years, with the rise of grower champagne, it's all of a sudden become a geek wine. And then as you start digging down into it, all of a sudden, it's even more the geek wine. It is the punk wine. It's busting out the seams against what the pigeonhole that we stuck it into. And that ultimately, all of these wines are more than just the single-minded stereotype that we allot them.
You can tell
I've either consumed too much coffee today or I've watched this movie too many bloody times and I really need to expand my brain a little bit more. But dude, I view everything, and I mean everything, through the lens of wine. And as I was watching this movie recently, it just hit me. 40 some odd years. No, it's 35 years after this movie came out that Hughes, holy shit, he's talked about the wine world writ large. And as, you know, the letter crafted by Brian, all five of them got together and decided Brian, the smart one, the brain, should craft the goddamn letter. And what he said to Vernon was, we accept the fact that we have had to sacrifice a whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay telling you who we think we are. You see us as you want to see us, in the simplest terms and the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each of us is a brain, an athlete, a basket case, a princess, and a criminal. Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club. Well, we, Jason, could write that about all these individual wines that we advocate for. My advocacy for Riesling puts it out there is, it's the punk. It's busting against the norm. It's trying to get that louder soundstage to sing from. But it's so much more than that. It is a kooky wine stylistically in terms of the multiplicity of styles. It is ultimately geeky as you go into the Mosel River Valley and look at the longest swath of vineyards in Europe around that beautiful bend from Bernkastel up to Erzig. There are Rieslings that are big and buxom in size. Think of Keller's Rieslings right now. And if you go back historically, it was the snobby goddamn wine. So like those characters embodying each one of those stereotypes, each one of these wines that we advocate for can do the same thing. And at the same time, Jason, the world of wine, we need to bust out of all of these stereotypes. For those of us who think, who say, oh, Chardonnay, it's always big, fat, buttery, oaky. Oh, French wine, it's the best. Period. Amen. Aussie wine, if there's not a critter on the label, I'm not drinking that shit. Canada, they can't make wine up there. We, wine people, fans of wines, harbor stereotypes too. And as that movie ended, The Breakfast Club, with stereotypes being turned on their proverbial ass, wine does that every day for us.
I think that this is working way better than I expected it to. I'm not going to lie to you, Paul. I want to start with the jock. I want to start with the jock, Emilio Estevez's character, which, you know, full disclosure, I wrestled in my youth as like a, you know, I wrestled on a team, and they kind of nailed that stereotype pretty well. It's not, you know, not from a negative or a positive. It's just, that's the kind of person that, you know, plays sports and does things. I don't mean with the same daddy issues or any of that kind of stuff, but I think it's interesting to choose that to be the big wine. And by big wine, I assume you mean these kind of like luscious, high Parker score type wines from Napa and maybe the right bank of Bordeaux. And maybe, is that what you mean?
Well, I guess we don't have to bring Mr. Parker into this conversation. I respect everything that Parker has done.
I do too. And I have said publicly many times how I think Parker is just, you know, unfairly derided by people who just don't understand what he did for wine.
Listen, anyone who gets more people to interact more often with wine, I'm a happy camper. I appreciate them. I applaud them. I do all of those things. So I will just eliminate that adjective from your description. Yes, I think the jock wine is the big wine, is the big bombastic wine. Think about when Andrew arrived that morning to detention. Typical jock, he's wearing the Letterman jacket. And what does he do? He immediately wants to fight the punk. Like they're barely in the goddamn detention. And already there's a fight breaking out. And where, after that, where does the jock sit down? Beside the pretty girl. Holy smigolies. And what does the jock bring to lunch that day? My God, that should be a whole separate podcast, dude. Four sandwiches, a bag of chips, a bag of cookies, a banana, apple, carton of milk. A massive meal for Saturday lunch that maybe, size-wise, can mimic these big wines. But, remember what happens to Andrew. He goes to the second floor of the library. Yes, he does smoke a joint, but then he starts dancing. And all of a sudden, this big, brawny dude becomes the most athletic, light on his feet, lithe individual possible. And so, you know, we look at labels of wines. And maybe not today, but certainly there was a few years ago where we looked at alcohol. I don't drink wine that is more than 14% alcohol or whatever our established limit was. And we refuse to give those wines any credit at all. So are you telling me, Jason, you cannot have a wine of so-called power, at least in the American mindset, without balance? And so that's what I attribute to Andrew Clark, the jock.
The thought of when you go to a tasting, and I don't want to single out brands, but I will single out, you know, wine styles, and you have, let's say, for lack of a better term, a big velvety, soft tannin, big red wine, which by the way, there's a time and place for. I enjoy those wines quite a bit. Next to the, well, Riesling's a perfect, it's perfect for the punk, actually, in the wine connotation. And you see the people who are acid heads who just hate the fact that this wine is, you know, does not have acid the same way. You're nailing it perfectly. You really are. It's, oh man. All right. So who's the pretty girl in this analogy? What wine is the pretty girl?
Well, Claire Standish, the snob. She's the prototypical popular girl, member of student council. She's the fashion plate with the diamond earrings. What does she bring to lunch, Jason? Sushi. Talk about an effete lunch for goddamn detention.
Especially in Chicago at that time.
It's just insane. So what could be, for many out there, a snobby, elitist wine? If only portrayed through marketing, if only portrayed through what we believed once to be the rare times you would drink it, it's got to be bubbles and it's got to be champagne. But what has happened over the last 20 years with the rise of grower champagne? And actually, holy smigoldies, Jason, we can go to trade tastings where we actually get to meet the individual who grew the grapes and made the champagne. It's like mind blown, for God's sakes. And oh, you start thinking about champagne as you would any other wine. The way we as Psalms interact with this wine. Who the fuck started decanting champagne, goddammit? That's just insane to me. We got rid of the fluted glasses and now we're serving champagne in big bowls. We have completely changed the view of champagne as a snobby wine. And it is just as great as every other still wine out there.
Awesome. Well, and it's funny because you think of champagne as a, I think there's a price attached to it. But honestly, from a standpoint of what it costs versus other wines, it's really not that much more expensive. Honestly, if you're going to get a Napa cab, you're probably paying north of $50, and that's probably what you're paying for a champagne. So it's a funny thing to think of it the way you're – I think the region champagne and the wine itself, they're at war with itself. You know, they are trying to be an everyday wine while maintaining the fact that they are a New Year's Eve wine. You know, and it's I think the analogy works really well with Claire.
Well, I'm not so sure that the producers that we think of in that grower champagne class follow suit with all of that marketing that we saw through the 80s and 90s into the early O's about champagne equals the good life. So I'm not agreeing with that side of things. And in terms of the cost, it is costlier than a lot of other wines out there. Why? Well, lest we forget, Jason, a lot of the champagnes that we interact with, they are aged for how long before they're released?
Oh, quite a bit.
And that costs money. So the actual process of the method champenoise may not be overtly more expensive than others, but how long they hold on to that wine, I'm willing to pay for that, goddammit. In essence, they are releasing the wine when it's time, as opposed to buying a super goddamn young wine that you're going to have to sell it for X period of time. So listen, the price, there's value at every price point, Jason. I assume we will agree on that. So I don't think champagne, for how it's made, is overpriced at all.
I've been to a lot of trade tastings, and I would assume you've been to 10 times that I've been to. And I will just say this. I'm going to leave it on the table. I could picture Claire being a rep for a champagne brand.
Oh, she'd be perfect, goddammit.
I mean, that's not to insult anybody. I have very dear friends that are reps for champagne brands, but Claire would fit. I'm just saying that. Let's move on to Burgundy as the geek. So the thing about Burgundy, which I love, is that it's gone through so many iterations throughout time. But it's always been this wine that's like you're either in the know or you're not. And it seems to be regardless of price. It's almost like, you know, give me your take on Burgundy as the geek and how it's evolved and, you know, changed.
Well, let's talk about the geek. Burgundy is an irrelevant part of this goddamn conversation. So Brian Johnson is the classic nerd. Smart, member of the Latin club, the math club, the physics club. What does his mother say to him, Jason, when she drops him off on that Saturday morning to use his time wisely to study more? Remember, Jason, why he got a fake ID? It wasn't to go out and buy beer so he and Jason could party on a Saturday night together. It was so he could goddamn vote. Think about the lunch he brought that day. Peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Oh, with the crust cut off. It was perfect. And so, yes, when you dive down into his smarts, how he approached his time in high school, what he had to achieve, on and on and on you go, I had to think of Burgundy and the minutiae of Burgundy and how a deep dive. You really have to get in there. You have to make sure that when you go to Burgundy with your sandwich that it is fucking perfect, that you are on point to attempt to absorb all that Burgundy has to tell you. And maybe I'm being too goddamn stereotypical of Burgundy because it's a joyful, yummy wine.
I spent a lot of time there. I don't know if you are, but keep going.
No, that's it. And listen, and we could expand it out for all of those Burgundy fans out there who are now pissed at me for putting Burgundy into that corner. Let's go to Barolo. What Barolo has done, what we have done with Barolo over the last 25 years, it was great. It was good enough, Jason. And I'm sure you were like this. In the 1990s, that we bought Barolo and we put it on our list and it went under our Italy category. And then we went, oh, we're going to put Barolo under our Piedmont category. And oh, what's the next step? God damn it. We have to list it by the commune. And when I buy Barolo, I have to make sure that I have a Lamora Barolo, that I have a Serra Lunga Barolo, that, you know, all of that stuff. And more wine regions are doing that. And so I think we're all ultimately wine geeks at the end of the day, and we all identify with Brian Johnson. It's just that Burgundy is the geekiest of them all.
Yeah, it's also Burgundy has an element of being kind of clubby. you know, and Brian was a member of many clubs. Mm-hmm. He was a guy who was an overachiever to some extent. And I think that Burgundy as a place and a wine wants to be simple. It has this image of like, you know, we're farmers, we're simple. We don't wear suits. You know, we're not like the Bordeaux region where they're very formal about things, but yet they are like that. You know, they are working very, very, very hard behind closed doors to have an image, you know? I think Barolo is also a really, really, really good analogy, but Burgundy's got a few more centuries baked in, you know, of this type of idea. And I think also the cool thing about Burgundy is like the Geek, you can go on forever there. You can go on forever. You know, if you want to, you know, you can dive into single areas of single parcels and talk about, you know, Amarose and how many different rows taste different from each row there. And it just works. The analogy is flawless there. I wonder from the Brian Burgundy angle, though, where does that character in this wine go? You know, how does that character in this wine, with its price skyrocketing and its knowledge deepening, where does it go in the future?
Well, listen, I think with the rise of, you know, Daniel Jonas's extraordinarily awesome La Palais, we all might approach Burgundy back in the day with kid gloves. Oh my God, it's rare, it's precious, let's be respectful, it's Mr. and Mrs., it's Sir, it's Madame. And then when we got to meet these actual producers and they want to cut a rug, just like you and I want to cut a rug. And ultimately, that's what Brian Johnson wanted to do. Remember why he was in detention on that day. He brought a flare gun to school that went off in his goddamn locker. It's just ludicrous. So where is Burgundy going wine-wise? Well, it's going further south, the Mâconnais, the Côte Chalonnaise, and now in its own little way, Beaujolais. We're beginning to talk about that as Burgundy. I think those producers are, they themselves, more than we are, moving away from that cult-centric, nerdy-esque thing. Maybe because they live it every day, they don't have to talk about it, but there is, the more and more Burgundy producers I meet, the more and more chill and cool they all are. That they're not the geeks that we might make them out to be from a distance.
No, I mean, you know, I was, when I filmed the second Somme film, I was sort of floored when I finally met Aubert de Vilaine and spent the day with him, and, you know, that scene is in the film. I couldn't believe that this guy was, I don't know what I was expecting in retrospect, because now I can only picture the man that exists, but I didn't expect it to be such a sweet man with a simple jacket and tennis shoes, who, while we were doing the interview, his eyes kept darting back and forth to a single vine that appears to have been dying and needs to be replanted. So I paused the interview and he said, "Can I just have 1 second? I need to go take a look at this one vine." He said, "I haven't been up here in probably about 9 days, and I don't remember this vine looking." So I think exactly what you're saying is exactly my experience from the top. And then, as you mentioned, the Mâcon, same. I mean, it's you're nailing this too prophetically for me. Okay, so now the orange wine and natty wine. So when you talk about the natural wine thing, and we're talking obviously about Ally Sheedy's character.
Yep.
Who is,
she's, know, the kook, the basket case.
I'm assuming we're going to go, you know, that trope where, oh my God, this girl's actually beautiful type of a thing.
Well, you got to end there, because that's one of the great scenes. Listen, the first half of the movie, the first half of Detention, she sits there at her table. She really doesn't speak at all. She just grunts. She dresses like a wild woman, hair's all over the goddamn place. You know, our initial interaction with her is sad. Even before she gets to the library, she gets out of the back seat of her car. Her parents have driven her to detention. Remember what happens next? She steps to the front driver's side window of the car to say goodbye to her parents, and they just drive off. Your heart is beating for Alison Reynolds. And then as the movie goes on, she starts to talk. First of all, her lunch is goddamn insane. Remember what she had for lunch? She had this, you know, the two pieces of white bread. She opened one of the straws filled with sugar, and then she put goddamn cereal on the thing. That was her lunch. And you're right. I'll jump ahead.
Well, I mean, there's also, you know, she does the dandruff on the drawing that she does. But what I love is she does that drawing and it's beautiful. You look at it, you're like, oh my God, you're an incredible artist. And then she shakes her hair and she puts snow all over it with the dandruff. Are we talking natural wine here?
Well, that's me in a mirror. So I really don't want to talk about that. But anyway, so, you know, but I will jump ahead to her towards the end of the movie, being taken aside by Claire. Claire does her hair, puts on a little makeup. All of a sudden, Allison emerges as the beautiful swan. So to go to wine, those kooky wines, and I guess it would be almost too easy to put the amber wine, orange wine, or the natural wine into this category. But, you know, I'm a simple man. That's where I'm going to go with these wines. And I will also confess on first blush, many of those wines come across that way. Initially off-putting. Initially, I don't understand the language that you're speaking, and I'm not even sure that you're speaking a proper language. This is completely alien and foreign to me. But because they are living, breathing things, the more time you spend, eventually you hit a point in your wine journey, at least I do, where a smile comes to your face and you're like, holy shit, I love this. This is yummy in a completely different way. I wouldn't have given you the time of day 6 hours ago, but now I want to have an intimate conversation with you. That's what I love about that classification of wine. And that's what I love about this character. Just the thought that on Monday, hopefully, as Brian asked his four fellow students towards the end of the detention, what's going to happen when we all see each other on Monday? Are we going to go back to our normal types, character types? Or are we actually going to be goddamn friends? And so I, wine-wise, have become much more friendly with that orange wine, amber wine, natural wine, that whole genre that I discounted for the longest period of time.
I think one of the big stupidest arguments that exists in wine is that natural wine is good or bad, or people freak out and they're like, oh, Alice Faring is, you know, I don't agree with her, or I don't agree with this, or it is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. Because if anybody's ever been in Paris and you just found yourself in a natural wine bar, the wines are freaking great in there. You have wines that are fantastic. If you ever had a Medio Pepe, that's a natural wine. They don't use sulfur. That's a fantastic wine. I think it's, you're nailing it in the way that it's perspective. And also, you know, you go to a region like Friuli, where they've made orange wine for a very, very, very long time, or Georgia or something like that, and the wines are great. And it's just a matter of these stupid trends that pop up and put people in boxes in wine that have always driven me nuts since I started making these films. I think when it comes to natural wine, the one problem is it's just not defined. And I think for the Ally Sheedy character, it's perfect. She's not goth. She's not, you know, emo or whatever that means. She doesn't really fit an easy stereotype. And I think natural wine is the same kind of thing. So that's why I think it's a really good analogy to use her. And then there are these ones where you taste it and you're like, this is a beautiful wine, but the others, I don't. So I think the whole wine world could use your message of what you're saying, in that, you know, delicious in a different way. What a profound statement, Paul, you know? It is. It's profound. And I'm speaking to the people, you know, like you, and even, you know, less than you, who have been to trade tastings and gone to like things like Texom and have watched my films and have absorbed the different, you know, maybe read Wine Spectator, and absorbed all the different ways you take in the bullshit opinions, you know. And frankly, any opinion on its own is bullshit. Really, I swear to God, you have to distill all of them as a singularity. And by the time you finally get to do that, I feel in life, you know, it's too late, you know, because you're about to die. So it's really important to hear what you're saying, especially about wine, because people just get too hung up on this crap. You know, that something's right or something's wrong. I'm probably after this podcast, I'm going to go have Ali Sheedy's lunch. I'm going to pour Captain Crunch. All right. So the most important thing that we have to talk about is who we are.
Well, I assume talking about Mr. Bender?
Yeah, I'm talking about Mr. Bender. So that's us, right? In this whole deal?
Well, you know what? I would presume if we could poll your listeners and my mother, that each one of us identified with one of these. And I immediately went to Bender. You know, his animosity at the beginning of the movie was admittedly off-putting. The shit that he did with the character Claire, some of that stuff was bullshit. But he took it upon himself to poke everyone in the ribs that day, to pull out of each one of them their inner secrets. And without Bender, we wouldn't have had a movie. We would not have this conversation right now.
What wine is Bender?
Oh,
I mean, who is he in this equation?
R-I-E-S-L-I-N-G. He is the Riesling. Okay. He is the punk.
Okay. Do you think Riesling would want to be that character? Or did we make Riesling that character?
Riesling right now is that character. And I think we could go back in time and even into the future and say Riesling was once the snob. Riesling was once the brain. Riesling was once the criminal. The basket case. And there's some expressions now that are going to become the jock. So I think Riesling, maybe over most wines, is all five of these stereotypes. And not to quickly run away from Mr. Bender, but Jason, there is a character in this movie who is the philosopher king that does not get the time of day that I think he deserves. And that would be Carl, the custodian engineer.
And because I was definitely going to him. Yeah. Okay, this is great.
Because as Carl says to the kids, I know more about you than you know about yourselves. Remember, he's the only one, when he first appears, to recognize that the clock in the library is 20 minutes fast. No one else saw that. And then you jump ahead to the heart-to-heart conversation that Vice Principal Vernon and he have down in the basement over beers. Vernon says, I've been teaching here for 22 years, and each year these kids are getting more arrogant. And Carl responds, bullshit. The kids haven't changed. You have. Well, you know what, Jason? Maybe these wines have always been the same. And we're the ones who have changed. And we've not been able to deal with that shit. Wine is very contextual. That's what makes it one of the reasons why it is the most awesome beverage on the planet. And we fail to acknowledge that on the day, we're different. The venue's different. Our guests are different. And maybe, just maybe, wine is exactly the bloody same. So if we approached wine with more open minds, leaving our stereotypes outside that high school on that Saturday morning, maybe, just maybe, some of our conversations with wine would be more impactful, would be more discerning, would be more open-minded, all of these things. And that's ultimately the message that I take away from The Breakfast Club.
You are a true master of the custodial arts. I'm going to tell you that.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I mean, so the janitor as the, well, I guess like the sage, I mean, he's the person who actually has distilled all the opinions. He's the unjaded, I've come to grips with my lot in life. I'm happy with where I'm at. And I can look past the stupid short-sighted insults. You know, that's the character. That's the one to be, I suppose. But who is the principal? Who is Principal Vernon?
Who the hell cares, Jason? I don't want to party with that dude.
Yeah, but I mean, what's his analogy to wine? Is he the critic? Is he the short-sighted sommelier? Is he the person who didn't keep expanding themselves in wine? I mean, who is this person?
Well, maybe, just maybe, he is that drinker of wine who walks into our restaurants and wine bars and retail shops, who says something along the lines of, I only drink Napa Cabs. I only drink red Bordeaux. Champagne is the best. All of those massive wine statements that are in all caps, bold font, all the goddamn time. And maybe sometimes you can't talk that person out of that. You can't introduce them to something new. But on the right day, with the right conversation, you can take that person on a journey. Maybe if there was a Breakfast Club too, we would have seen what would have happened to Vernon after he read that note that Brian crafted on that Saturday and left at 4 p.m. I think Vernon has the potential for change. We just simply never got to see it.
Please don't make a Breakfast Club 2.
I can barely run a goddamn wine bar. Make a movie? Are you crazy?
Please. Well, you're in extraordinary circumstances for a wine bar, but I imagine it's hard under any circumstances. Paul, this is one of my favorite conversations I've had in this godforsaken year. Now I'm going to rewatch this movie. I just watched it again last night for probably the 20th time, and I'm going to watch it again tonight now.
Perfect.
I want everybody to watch Breakfast Club. I want them to have, how many bottles of wine do they need to have in front of them?
I think you have to be five,
two,
dude.
Three, four, five bottles. And you should probably watch it with, like, you know, somebody really stuck up who only likes one kind of wine, and make them drink all five wines while you watch it, and go from there.
Done.
Paul, it has been a pleasure. You are a good man.
Jason, my pleasure, dude.
Let's go watch a movie.
True.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope that made a little bit of a little bit of sense for you guys. It's really fun to talk about stuff that is not just straight wine, so I hope you enjoy it. And man, do I love The Breakfast Club. I'm going to rewatch it again right now. Don't forget to go to SomTV.com. Verticals is coming, Blind Tasting Sessions is coming, and a whole host of new series and shows we've been working on, including new films, the whole deal. I cannot wait to see you guys on SomTV and on this podcast. Thank you. Bye-bye.